Hello, everybody. I'm afraid I'm going to make you think about horrid and nasty things once again. Darken the tone a little bit. There's a handout coming round with some quotations and some images on it to accompany this talk. And the first one, when you get it, is what I'm going to start with. And it's an extract from W.J. Burley's detective novel, Wycliffe and the Scapegoat. Where did you go? I went to see a film in Penzance. You drove over in your car? Yes, were you alone? Yes, there was nobody with me. He seemed to think more was required. They were showing a film called Straw Dogs, which was made near here. So I was interested. And this extract is Detective Superintendent Wycliffe questioning a suspect in this novel, Wycliffe and the Scapegoat. Bit of a spoiler alert here. This man is the murderer. This is Matthew Choke, who has, in fact, murdered his uncle, as we discover during the course of the book. But note that his alibi is a cinematic one. He's been to see Straw Dogs, a nasty early home invasion movie, which some of you will undoubtedly have seen, which was indeed filmed in Cornwall. Which, you know, culminates in a massacre, basically, featuring all sorts of ingenious ways of killing people on screen, and directed by Sam Peckinpah, who was famous for his bloody cinema, horror and westerns. So Matthew's viewing tastes, our suspect here, might lead us to think of him as an unstable, violent man himself, potentially, certainly in the context of the novel. But alongside this fan of blood-stained and Cornish cinema, Wycliffe is also investigating another aspect of the murder of this man's uncle here. And this is a fire festival that takes place in the village every year, we hear as we read through the novel. In it, a great wicker wheel is rolled down the cliffs and falls into the sea, bearing with it an effigy inside it, known as the Scapegoat, hence the title of the novel Wycliffe and the Scapegoat. And the Scapegoat is supposed to carry evil out of the town when people set fire to him. And this is the second extract on your handout, when Wycliffe attends this fire festival to see what's going on in the village. An eerie blast on a horn signalled the start. The master of ceremonies, in a white druidical robe, mounted the platform. A girl wearing a long white gown carried aloft a burning torch, which gave off a great deal of tarry smoke. "She's supposed to be a virgin," Zila explained in a stage whisper, "but I wouldn't like to bet on that one." So it's kind of made a bit jokey. There are ceremonial words spoken in Cornish, and the whole thing sounds very grand. And Zila says to Wycliffe, originally it was no effigy tied up in there, but a live man. So we've got a sense that there's something that could be quite solemn going on here. At the same time, it's also kind of being mocked. And W.J. Burley, the author of the novel, who was a Cornish schoolteacher, I think is very conscious of this tension that he's creating around this fire festival. He sort of wants us to think it's funny, but he sort of wants us to think it's sinister as well. And that's a theme that will come up throughout this paper with the text that I'm going to look at. So I want to draw attention to how in the novel Burley sketches out this complex of ideas about Celtic identity. He's very keen to say this is a Celtic fire festival, we're in this Celtic village, you know, here is Cornwall at its darkest and most frightening. All sorts of horrible things may be going on in this village. And these stereotypes about Celts go back a very, very long way, as I'm sure some of you already know. All the way back to the third extract on the handout, Julius Caesar, and his history of the Gallic Wars. The whole nation of the Gauls, Caesar tells us, is greatly devoted to ritual observances. And for that reason, those who are smitten with the more grievous maladies and who are engaged in the perils of battle either sacrifice human victims or vow to do so, employing the Druids as ministers. They believe, in effect, that unless for a man's life be paid, the majesty of the immortal gods may not be appeased. Others use figures of immense size, whose limbs, woven out of twigs, they fill with living men and set on fire, and the men perish in a sheet of flame. They believe that the execution of those who have been caught in the act of theft or robbery is more pleasing to the immortal gods, but when the supply of such fails, they resort even to the execution of the innocent. So we have the Druids here again, and you can see that Burley, when he describes this fire festival in his Cornish village, is thinking about precisely these kind of stereotypes. We've got all the same kind of descriptions here of people wearing white robes, of druids, of wicker, the material itself out of which the wicker figure is made, the fire ritual. It's all there. Burley would have encountered these kind of stereotypes in his wide reading on Cornish antiquities, especially perhaps in the work of people like William Borlase, with whom I'm sure some of you are familiar. But in this case, Burley uses the stereotype to set up a red herring. It's a misdirection for readers trying to solve the murder ahead of Wycliffe. There is, in fact, no body trapped inside the wicker wheel that runs down the cliff. It is just an effigy in there. There's nothing going on. The druid is not the murderer. It's Matthew, the man's nephew. And his motives are incredibly rational and modern. He's basically been embezzling from his uncle's business and kills him as a result of that to cover it up. So actually, Burley presents Cornwall as a place where money and law and reason and actually really rather boring financial motives are far more potent than these ancient Celtic magics. It's just it's a misdirection to lead the reader astray. What Wycliffe encounters in Cornwall is, of course, part of the Celtic revival, the movement to invent or reinvent traditions in the interest of Cornish self-assertion in the 19th century. The folklorist Robert Hunt, William Botterill, and Margaret Courtney, and people like Henry Jenner and Robert Morton Nance, popularised notions of Celtic survivals in Cornish culture. And they also identified the Celts as a specific people as well. So the idea was that they were either an immigrant people or some kind of indigenous people. The trouble was that nobody could quite settle on what it was that they thought they were, so that many writers came up with many different understandings of who the Celts were. And as we were hearing from Nick earlier, these people are also thought to have brought with them or invented in situ a whole range of customs, which they then carried on in their Cornish villages from time immemorial. So like the Howland Tower performance, the furry dance here, the obios at Padstow, midsummer bonfires, things like that. So Jenner, Nance, Hunt, Botterill were people who all thought that the Celts were associated with these kind of old folklore customs. It is kind of difficult to say what Celtic means when we think of it today. It could mean an ethnic group of people. It could mean a linguistic group of people. It is quite hard to say. And there have been all sorts of suggestions about who those people might be. Everything from Germanic, Aryan, maybe Gallic or Hispanic people, right the way through to, and these were some of the ones that I did particularly enjoy, Greeks, Phoenicians, or black Ethiopian Cushites, which I think was the best one. A chap called Godfrey Higgins, writing in the early 19th century, decided that the Cornish had actually immigrated from Ethiopia and were thus to be traced back to Africa. So the Celts are a little bit hard to pin down, but nevertheless they're a very interesting people. And in particular, given how hard they are to pin down, it's interesting that they've been endowed with what is actually a very rigid and often quite derogatory set of characteristics by people, especially Victorians, writing racial theory. So in The Races of Man in 1862, for example, the scientist Robert Knox was able to sum up what he thought the truth about Celts was. He said they possessed furious fanaticism, a love of war and disorder, a hatred for order and patient industry, and that they were restless, treacherous, uncertain. Look at Ireland, he added at the end. Which is particularly chucking, really, isn't it? The poet and critic Matthew Arnold, although he was much more sympathetic to the idea of Celtic identity, was in many ways equally unhelpful. In his 1867 essay on the study of Celtic literature, he called the Celts idealistic, magical, imaginative, egalitarian, but he also said, really rather echoing some of Knox's conclusions, that they were superstitious, excitable, and subversive. He said they were troubled by a perpetual straining after mere emotion and prevented from reasoned progress by an inability in what he called the skillful and resolute appliance of means to ends. So Celts were often represented as a people who were too sentimental, too poetical, too literary in a lot of ways, too musical, too subversive, too imaginative. They were incapable of self-discipline, and particularly, and of course this has a political context, they were incapable of self-government, therefore. When people in the Victorian period thought of Celts, they often thought of Fenians in Ireland or people rebelling in Scotland around the fringes of the British Isles, basically, and they saw that as a Celtic threat. So when we come back to where I started with a text from the late 1960s, 1970s, It seems to me that British national culture needed those images again in the 1960s and 70s. And the texts I'm going to talk about today, the ones I've talked about already, like Wycliffe and the Scapegoat and Straw Dogs and The Wicker Man, with which I'm going to finish, seem to me to incarnate all those Celtic dangers that people were thinking about again in the 1960s and 70s, just as they had in the 1860s and 70s. When you think about it, the 60s and 70s were periods of great unrest. In 1969, a new faction of the Provisional IRA emerged, and the British government began to focus once again on the idea of Celts as dangerous. And you also had discourses of great worry about immigration, so Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech in 1968, for example. So there was a sense that Britain was a troubled polity and that British people were becoming concerned about people who might be insiders or outsiders, but either way might be problematic and dangerous. Nationalists such as Plaid Cymru and the Scottish National Party won some by-elections in the period. The Scottish Nationalists took 11 seats, which seems like a very small number these days. And the Cornish Nationalist Party also, Mabey and Kernow, began to contest elections locally, like Falmouth and Camborne, from 1970. So there was increased interest both among those who regarded themselves as Celtic nationalists and those who regarded them as Celtic and threatening nationalists in the idea of separatism. So that there was debate about Celticity, for example, in the House of Commons. The Conservative MP Bernard Brain said in 1977 that what he called Celtic fanatics were little men who are now taking us down a path which will lead inevitably to the breakup of our country. So some of the discourses that we hear in modern politics were being tried out in the 60s and 70s, but with really increased violence, I think. So when you look at texts like Straw Dogs, when people come to Cornwall, horrible things happen to them, or Wycliffe and the Scapegoat, where nasty goings-on are happening in the Celtic village, and, as they say, The Wicker Man, which I'm going to finish, I think you can see Britain in the 1960s and 70s is experiencing a kind of specifically Celtic crisis. And these horror texts, these texts about the dark village, the dark Celtic village, as being part of that, that conversation that British people are having about who they are. As Jim was saying earlier, actually, the story of The Wicker Man began as a Cornish story. It's now seen very much as a Scottish text because of the 1973 film, which was shot in Scotland and is about Scottish identity. But it begins with one of the texts that you've got a picture of on your handout. If you flip it over, you can see the novel Ritual on the back of it. On the front, there are some stills from the film The Wicker Man. You can see Sergeant Howie there being dragged off to be burned in The Wicker Man, just as Caesar said he would be. And on the back, you've got the novel Ritual that you can see, which is the Cornish novel on which the film The Wicker Man is then based. Ritual is by a novelist called David Pinner, and it begins with the discovery of a child's body, and this is the fourth extract on your handout. So these are the first lines of the novel. The oak tree was very old. One of its lower branches had recently been snapped off, and some 5 feet below, a monkey's head and 3 garlic flowers had been fastened to the trunk by a hat pin. Yet the little girl, who was asleep in its shadow, seemed unaware of the tree or its strange decorations. Diane Spark was 8 years old and very dead, and she is the person you can see on the front cover. It's rather a blurry front cover, it's quite an odd front cover, but there are a pair of little legs sticking out of the blur under the tree, meaning to evoke that the death of that little girl at the beginning of the novel. The inference here, I think, is clear. You can see the idea that this is an oak tree, and the Druids were widely regarded as people who worshipped oaks, or worshipped under oaks, worshipped in groves, and this was a current idea and culture in the 1960s and 70s. And we also find Druids in the village. Ritual's pagan children desecrate the churchyard, they steal the crucifix, they practice magic on dolls. So it's one of those villages where the children are sitting around the graveyard sticking pins in their dollies, and you know that something is very badly wrong. There are also some occultists who keep a witchcraft museum, which I think is clearly about Boscastle. The witchcraft museum moved to Boscastle in 1960. And I think David Pinner had encountered it and thought, ooh, something interesting and strange is going on in this westerly Celtic place. Let me write something about witchcraft and paganism there. And you can see the Celtic rituals and religions that he embodies in the novel, defined as far as they're going to be by Diane's elder sister, Anna. And this is the fifth extract on your handout. This is what she says the villagers are up to when they're worshipping their ancient Celtic gods. Fire is a symbol of power, she says. God is in the fire, not the Christ God, but the dark God. Tomorrow night we celebrate God. We will dance to give us power over corn and over ourselves. This tree, and she's gesturing to the oak tree here under which her sister was found dead, is magical. Our God believes in blood. Your God, my God, our God is freedom, complete freedom to do anything. And finally, as if this were not enough, we learn that the community is held together by this kind of orgiastic rite that they hold on the beach every year, in which they sacrifice a white horse and then eat it, uncooked, basically. And it's this horrible moment in the novel, but it's all been leading up to this. We've seen the horse trembling in the field for quite some time, and we know what's going to happen, and the horse knows what's going to happen. It's based on Gerald of Wales, the writer from the late medieval period, who wrote an account of supposedly an ancient Irish rite in which kings bathed in horses' blood. So it comes from there. It's a Celtic rite, but it's a very heavily mythologised one, and it's very badly defined a ritual, I think. But nevertheless, it is a Celtic religion that Pinner is trying to tell us about in this novel and present it as this overwhelming, frightening threat. What ritual gave to the Wicker Man, then, was a compendium of popular myths about the beliefs of ancient Celts, and especially their dangerous nature. The film transposes all of this from Cornwall to Scotland, but it does carry with it, I think, these Victorian stereotypes about who Celts are, and it carries with it the idea that the Cornish Celt is particularly dangerous. However, this time there is a twist. So in The Wicker Man, our policeman, Sergeant Howie, goes to the Scottish Island to discover, as he thinks, the murderer of a child there, Rowan Morrison, who has disappeared. But as we go through the film, and again, spoilers, sorry, I hope this doesn't spoil the film for you, he discovers that she is not the intended sacrifice, but he is. And so he is dragged off and burned in The Wicker Man at the end of the film. Ritual sort of sets this up, but it does it in a rather different way, because in Ritual, when we've seen Diane Spark murdered at the beginning of the novel, a London policeman comes in to investigate what has happened here. He's not sacrificed himself, but rather bizarrely, it turns out that he is the murderer. Now, I didn't see that coming, and when I finished the novel, I wasn't sure that I was convinced by the plot of it. But it is fascinating because it points to the way that in a number of these texts, it's not the Celtic insiders who are the danger, actually. It is the incomers. And if you think back to Straw Dogs, think back to Matthew Choke's recommendation of film viewing that we talked about at the beginning of the paper, that's also what happens there, isn't it? The incomers. And you can see Dustin Hoffman there on the poster. The incomers, rather disturbingly, university professors who have come to this Cornish village, on holiday to live in a holiday cottage there. They are the more violent people in the film. Yes, a massacre occurs at the end of the film, but it's actually Dustin Hoffman in all his, unimpressive 5-foot nothingness with his shotgun and his man trap that does most of the damage in that film. So I think there's something really interesting going on in these texts from the 60s and 70s, basically. Yes, there is an old stereotype about Celtic paganism, Celtic religiosity, the Celts as a dangerous people. But there's also the idea that incomers into Celtic polities, so representatives of state, especially policemen, people who might be seen as English or non-Celtic or American or people from other places, basically, might bring with them a kind of dangerousness too. And that perhaps it's the Celtic place that lets that dangerousness out. Perhaps they discover something about themselves there which turns them into dangerous people. So, the dark Celtic village is not necessarily dark because it's full of Celts. It's also dark because it's a kind of meeting place between cultures where tensions flash and burn, I guess. Okay, thank you.